Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. When today's guest, historian and journalist Clay Risen, began doing research for his new book about the Red Scare in 2019, he had no idea that Donald Trump would be back in office. He had no idea we'd be dealing with attacks on civil liberties, book bans, pressure on media outlets and universities, the targeting of immigrants, the firing of government workers, smashing the federal government, and so much more. Clay Risen provides much-needed historical context in his new book, Red Scare: Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay Risen is an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times and author of many works of American history, including his latest, Red Scare. Hi, Clay. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, so much of this happened after we last had you on, and I'm wondering what you're thinking now that we are 8 months into this administration. Did you think that Trump and the Republicans would be causing so much damage so fast?
Well, you know, I think like a lot of people, it's really stunning to not only have gone through the first couple of months of the administration where we saw some pretty groundbreaking, norm-breaking, law-breaking steps by the administration, and then not be able to catch one's breath. You know, it's just been kind of at warp speed for 8 months, and it's astounding. I had no idea.
We just started a new series called The Authoritarian Playbook, and we're on episode 3. And I've been struck by the guests who are historians. They've written books about authoritarianism and fascism. And they all said, we just did not realize things would move so quickly. And the other thing, Clay, is I'm wondering what you're watching, because it's hard to keep up. Thomas Edsall of the New York Times had a column a couple days ago, and he writes, Trump is winning. Universities retreat under pressure. Law firms submit to extortion. Scientific and medical research funding has been decimated. Federal employees face ideological purges. Tariffs are imposed as political weapons. The military has become a domestic police force. Trump targets each constituency in isolation, leaving all divided and vulnerable. So what are your thoughts about this? Because it's just hard to keep up with it all.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I agree with all that. Certainly as a historian, I think back to, you know, the period I write about in the book in the 40s and 50s, but you know, also to the 1930s in Germany, for example, where you saw, you know, rapid institutional destruction, norm destruction, rewriting of social contracts. What I think happens time and again is that, you know, there's an establishment that just doesn't move fast enough and can't really plan for or accept the sudden shift of ground. And so, you know, you end up with institutions, you know, like colleges and universities or law firms or the judiciary that think that things are going to work the way they always have worked. And to some extent, that means that everyone else is going to kind of play their part. And yet at the same time, because, as you said, the administration goes after each one with a kind of a surgical, overwhelming surgical strike, you know, only Harvard or only Columbia. They feel like, well, we can give in because everyone else is going to pick up the slack, but we just can't afford not to do this. And of course, and then very quickly they look around and see, oh, no one else is picking up the slack. And in fact, the administration has a very careful strategy in terms of going after everybody one by one, singling them out to the point where there's really no hope of mass action.
Why do you think institutions did not prepare for this? Because so much of what we are seeing was laid out for everyone to read in Project 2025.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a naivete and that persists in any kind of status quo, right? You're invested in the idea that everything is going to be basically the way it is, and that you can't imagine someone coming along and destroying that. It's interesting. Since we last talked, I actually spent a month in Germany as a reporter, and it got me thinking about how things are different in Germany. And one of the things is they have very strong laws against radicalism and radicalization. They have a government, a structure that's set up to prevent the rise of the far right or the far left. And it's interesting that, it clearly took something catastrophic for them to basically be in kind of a never again situation or a posture. And that's something that we in the United States, despite times like the Red Scare or the Civil War and the tumult of the 19th century, we still assume that, well, everyone is on the same page in terms of the playbook, right? That we're all going to treat the Constitution in the same way. We're all going to invest in these norms. We're all going to basically play toward a consensus. And then someone comes along from the fringes and upsets all of that, and it takes a long time, a disturbing long time, but too long to adjust. And at this point, I'm not sure that there's anything that can be done in the short term to check the damage that we're seeing.
Given that you have written an entire book on the Red Scare and have done so much work studying what happened back then, what was really striking to me when we did our Project 2025 series, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the public's awareness and thinking that this could not happen here. So we would have guests on who would say, they want to dismantle the Department of Education. They want to get rid of labor laws, on and on and on. And people would say, that can't happen. What are your thoughts about that? And did you hear similar sentiments during the Red Scare, that that just can't happen here?
Well, yeah, of absolutely. That's a great similarity between then and today. Just, fundamental belief. I mean, I think during the Red Scare, you saw this with a character like Harry Truman. Harry Truman really, like a lot of other people, assumed, first of all, that communism was not really a threat in terms of, a disruption, a revolution, that there was a threat from the Soviet Union and there was a threat of espionage, but it wasn't like America was going to suddenly be taken over and turned into a Soviet state. But he took that pretty far. And, he believed that, therefore the Red Scare itself is sort of, it's a lot of talk. And he created, through an executive order, a loyalty program that he thought would just kind of be kind of a sop to Red Baiters. And instead it became this, it kind of took on a life of its own and was used by the Red Baiters as a way to go after thousands of government employees. It was modeled by private sector and local governments, became kind of a program sheet for how to run the Red Scare. And I think what you see there and what you see today is just this naivete that, well, it can't happen here. That Truman believed that no one would actually try to violate civil liberties in a massive way, because that's not American. That's not what we do. And I think the same thing, something similar happened this time, right? That there was this belief that, well, Trump tried it once, the first administration, and we saw where that went. And it was sort of, maybe not great, but nothing bad happened, really. I mean, this is the, I think, what a lot of voters thought, and a lot of pundits. And so, well, it can't be any worse than that, right? And so they looked at things like Project 2025, which is very explicit about what it wanted to do and very clear in its ambitions. And yet, because of its enormity, people assumed, well, that could never happen, right? No one would actually do something like that. And no administration under Trump could possibly be competent enough to implement all those things. And of course, that is exactly what happened. And I think people still haven't processed just how much all of this was planned out and staffed and ready to go. I mean, the whole idea of Project 2025 was, we've got the ideas, we've got the people, we've got the playbook. bring us in and this will happen within 9 months. And, they've achieved a lot of their goals.
Exactly. And the other important point is that in the first administration, you had far-right conservatives who stood up to Trump. And these are very conservative people who said, no, we're not going there. And they wanted to make sure that didn't happen again. And so they planned a couple years in advance that they would only hire people who had loyalty to Trump. And that's what we're seeing now. Are there any comparisons between that and what happened during the Red Scare?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think one thing that people often, what I would say, sort of middle of the road types, people who are invested in the status quo, the establishment, and certainly people who watched what happened during the first Trump administration, they sort of assume that, well, there can't be that many people out there. Like, there might be a Stephen Miller, but there can't be hundreds of Stephen Millers, right? That just people, there aren't that many, people with that kind of worldview and that kind of competence who are going to make this happen. Something very similar happened during the Red Scare. I mean, the Red Scare was not just McCarthy and Roy Cohn. In fact, it was only partly them. The Red Scare was really hundreds of government employees, of sort of private sector figures who sort of self-declared themselves as sort of arbiters of who should be able to work in one industry or another. This happened a lot in Hollywood. And a lot of these folks were very good at what they did, and they were very networked, and they knew each other and they talked to each other. And there was money that was, that went into organizations that helped structure all of this. And it happened very quickly. And it was something I try to map in the book, is that the Red Scare was not just this amorphous period of fear, but it was actually a structure. And there was a not a conspiracy, but there was a world of people who made this happen. And I think one of the things that a guy like Truman, or anybody who was surprised by the Red Scare, one of the things they must have been thinking was, where did these people come from? This is It's not only not American, these people are not acting like the Americans that I know, that I think people should be. And I think that's what we're seeing today, is just, where, who are these people? To be honest, that strikes me all the time. Like, how can you have so many people who not only approve of what's happening, but actively engage in things like ICE raids and these massive cuts to government programs, or all these things happening at the CDC? It's not just RFK. It is a whole group of people around him who are making that happen. And maybe I'm naive. I know I'm naive. I'm very naive. But I am astounded that there are that many people who want this to happen.
What are your thoughts about the Democratic Party's, a lot of people would say, lack of response, that they are still in the old, they have this old-fashioned line of thinking that you've got to compromise with the other side, and some are saying that just doesn't work anymore. This is a very different Republican Party, and too many people in the Democratic Party are still living in that time where you could find compromise. And yet these people are just smashing the state and doing things that, can you imagine if Obama did some of these things and how,
Well, I
what the
think there's
response would be?
yeah well I think there's a real irony here, and it is that when you traditionally, when you talk to someone who's a centrist Democrat, let's say, an open-minded centrist Democrat, their criticism of those further to the left than them, and they would say, well, it would be great if we had European style healthcare. It would be great if we could afford a massive welfare state, but we can't. Let's be realistic, right? This is a country that is pragmatic, realistic, and we have to work with the other side. This is how things are. Let's be adult about it, right? And so that's the typical way of dismissing the left. But the irony is that now I think the tables have really turned. And so you have people like Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, who still hold to this very naive idealism about how things should work, right? Oh, we'll work with the other side. We will have compromises. We will work as if it was 2015 again, when in fact, it's the people on the left who are being more pragmatic, who are saying, that's not the way things work anymore. The way things work are fight to the death. And, you know, whether you like it or not, that's the way politics, especially in Congress, and especially in many states, certainly from the White House, that's how it works now. And there's no way getting around it. You can't wish that Mitch McConnell or John Thune or Mike Johnson, you can't wish that they would do things differently. I mean, you can, but that and 50 cents will get you, you know, a Snickers bar. I mean, it's just not possible. And so I think there's this real irony there. And so the people who are, I think, are the more pragmatic ones, at least in the immediate term, are actually people on the left. And you listen to someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or, you know, Sherrod Brown, he's not in office now, but he's going to run again. And, you know, I think they're not the dreamers anymore.
We have an email from David who says, where is the Democratic Party's Project 2030 plan? How do you fight fire without a plan?
I mean, that's a great question. And I know there are people out there who are, you know, there is a Project 2029 out there that is largely centrist. It's being driven by centrists. I think if you look at the folks who are sort of circling around the abundance agenda, right? These are all people who are talking about, well, what do we do once we get back in office? You know, I think that there's something to be said for all those plans. They are not, to me, one thing that's missing is the kind of sharper edged version of 2025 that I think the writer is alluding to. You know, how do you do something that isn't just an updating of traditional centrist democratic policies? What's the new policy out there? Because I think when you look at the numbers and you look at, you know, what the public wants, it's open to some pretty liberal ideas in a way that, you know, maybe it hasn't in the past. I think the window has opened in a way for policies that in the past maybe wouldn't have sailed. And so I think there's room now to do big things that might have been written off in the past in something like a truly progressive Project 2029, 2030. But, you know, I don't think the Democratic Party is in a place right now to do that. It's weird because on the one hand, there aren't huge rifts in the party. You know, a lot of it is tactical. A lot of the debates are on policy levels. And yet there's really no conversation about how do we as a party take on the present? I think honestly, you know, the leadership has a lot to answer for right now.
Today, we are speaking with Clay Risen about his new book, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay is an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times, author of many books about U.S. history. If you have any questions for Clay about what he found, about the similarities between what we're dealing with right now and the Red Scare, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Clay, you write that the Red Scare was a wave of hysteria about the supposed threat of communism in the U.S. during the Cold War. It peaked in the early 1950s, lasted for more than a decade, and permeated pretty much every aspect of public and private life, directly affecting millions of Americans. I wonder what your thoughts are, because I'm noticing when people say that we're living in unprecedented times, and I've said that many times, some historians say, is that the right word to use? Because we have been here before. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about the differences between what we're seeing under this administration and what happened during the Red Scare?
Yeah, well, I think under this administration is the first big difference. During the Red Scare, both the Truman administration and the Eisenhower administration, while they participated in it, they were not cheerleaders of the Red Scare. They may, I think you can say that they did things to facilitate it, but they also tried to check it. And ultimately, Eisenhower played a pretty important role in bringing the Red Scare to an end. Today, obviously, the administration is the one that's driving this, and more, and so that's important, and it's really important because the administration has made it clear that it's going to basically act like a monarchy, and an absolutist monarchy, and an authoritarian one, and do whatever the president wants. So that's a big difference, very dangerous. But also, would another thing in the Red during the Red Scare, there was still an establishment. Both a Democratic but also a Republican establishment. There were liberal Republicans, but there were generally Republicans who really were invested in the process of the status quo and the norms, everything that until recently we sort of took for granted, were the kind of the safeguards of our democratic process. And today, I think this is the thing that maybe is the biggest difference and really the most striking thing for a lot of historians, and something that historians will be piecing apart for a long time, is how quickly and sort of effectively the Republican establishment withered away. And even people who you hear privately, oh, Mitch McConnell hates Donald Trump. Well, he didn't do very much to express that. And in fact, at critical moments, he stood by and either facilitated or looked the other way when Trump acted, especially in the first term. And so, why did it happen that way? What happened? And there are lots of explanations and theories, but I think that's something when people write about this 50 years from now, they'll be asking. So, that's I think the biggest difference. Have we been here before? You can certainly look to the Red Scare and find lots of similarities. And in fact, I think you could also, again, maybe years from now, someone could write a book about, what the kind of conspiracy mongering and radical right anti-government sentiment that took root in the Red Scare, in some ways was the forerunner of what we've seen today. This kind of very, I think a lot of the Red Scare was a proxy war for taking on the New Deal and for fighting against the progressive wave of the 1930s and 40s. And so much of what's happening now, and you talk about Project 2025 or some of the rhetoric coming from J.D. Vance and others in the administration, is very pointed about finally getting to tear down the New Deal state and to take apart not just government excess or the traditional targets of Republican reform, but fundamentally dismantle the New Deal. And so I think that there is this continuity. And so there is this sort of sense of, well, we've been here before, or this is part of a bigger story. It's so much like the parable of the blind men describing the elephant. You look at it one side and one grabs a tail or the trunk or the side, and it's going to be described differently. So I think it will be a while before we'll be able to step back and say, well, what really happened in the 2020s in America?
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're spending the hour with award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times, Clay Risen. He's out with a new book, The Red Scare: Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Clay Risen, award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times, and author of several works of U.S. history, including his latest, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. If you have any questions for Clay about the research that he did, history is so important right now, especially when Trump and so many in his circle are trying to rewrite history and whitewash history. What are your thoughts? If you have any questions about the differences and the similarities between what we're dealing with now and what people dealt with back then, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Clay, the work that you do is now more important than ever. And since you've been talking about the New Deal, and because that's so connected to the Red Scare, before we talk about really how the Red Scare came about, can you just remind us about the New Deal? I think this is so important. And you write that Roosevelt's domestic agenda delivered hundreds of thousands of public jobs, billions of dollars in economic support, and above all, a New Deal for the American people, asserting the power of the government to create guardrails around the economy. And I think this is where people forget, because we focus so much on the economic changes, but you write it catalyzed dramatic social change. It opened the doors to women and African Americans, industrial unions newly protected by the Labor Relations Board. Even gay men and lesbians were finding occasional refuge and opportunity to be themselves amid Washington's fast-growing cosmopolitan culture. The old order was breaking down. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, the difference between 1920s America and 1930s America is so striking and is often, I think, forgotten today. The 1920s, maybe some people remember it as the Jazz Age or the, you know, the Prohibition era gangsters and whatnot, but it was actually a very conservative time for much of the country. And yet, when the Depression came, so many of the social mores and cultural structures that existed and seemed to be persistent in the 1920s, you know, whether it was white supremacy, and its hold over large swaths of American life, not just in the South, the dominance of Protestant evangelical Christianity, over legislation, the presence of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. And they ran, large cities had openly Klan mayors. In the 1930s, I don't want to idealize it and make it sound like it was great. It was obviously the depths of the Depression. But what you saw under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal was a reversal of that. And, you know, suddenly you had people who had once been marginalized, you know, whether they were women or people of color or labor unions, suddenly had a seat at the table, whether it was literally the table in terms of making policy or just the cultural table, you know, able to make music and write and sing and be celebrated in that way. There was, for a while, a federal theater project. It was part of the New Deal. And it took not only plays, but also what they called living newspapers out into the public all around the country, performing, spreading the news, talking about what was going on, connecting people in a way that they'd never been connected before. You know, I grew up in Tennessee, and my family goes way back in Appalachia and rural parts of the country. And my grandparents grew up in the New Deal, and they would tell stories about, you know, what was it like for their grandparents and their parents and the kind of just dirt poverty that they grew up in, and how quickly it changed in the 1930s when services and programs like the Tennessee Valley Authority came in and brought electricity and paved roads and parks and, you know, leisure activities, these things, and labor protections. It completely changed American life, and it set a promise. Right, the very idea of the New Deal is not just what we're doing today, but what's going to happen down the road. Life will be better for your children and their children. And this is the vision of the New Deal. And yet there were many people who did not buy into this, who did not like it. And of course, you can imagine who that would be. It was, you know, obviously people who wanted a smaller government. There was a lot of criticism from the wealthy and from some large industries, but also white supremacists and people who didn't want to see women succeed and people who did not want America to become a more diverse cosmopolitan world. And it's interesting to go back and read some of that, some of those, what at the time sounded like pretty extremist criticisms of this new America of the 1930s. And actually, today they sound pretty current. It's frightening. When Eric Schmidt, from the politician from Missouri, he gave a speech at the National Conservative Conference the other day, and people pointed out how extremist it was, how he talked about, America as this kind of white ethno state. But the things he was saying would have fit right in with these criticisms and the opposition to the New Deal era of the 1930s.
Right. And then this is also very similar. You write that starting in 1933, so many said the New Deal was being run by an East Coast elite fed into a tax on the administration as not just un-American, but as a tool of Soviet subversion. It became commonplace for right-wing congressmen and radio demagogues to smear the New Deal as a stalking horse for Soviet-style collectivism. Later generations called it the deep state.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also striking to read some of floor speeches by congressmen or these tracts that were incredibly well read, or listen to radio broadcasts from the time. And one of the most salient critiques was that the New Deal was not an American project, was not something for the people, but it was being imposed by an intellectual elite, by a Harvard elite or an Ivy League elite, which is only partly true, but certainly there were a lot of college-educated people who were running the New Deal at a time when most people didn't go to college. But nevertheless, there was this sense that the New Deal was a foreign idea, and then it was only a step, a half step from there to say, well, what if it's not, the sort of sui generis American idea, then what is it? Well, it must be a Soviet idea. And of course, it is a progressive idea about the power of the government to do good things. Well, that sort of does push it toward a certain kind of, maybe social welfare state. People very easily conflate a lot of terms, and suddenly that's communistic. And we see it again today, the way that Trump and his allies talk about Zoran Mamdani here in New York running for mayor. He is a member of the Democratic Socialist Alliance. He is running as a Democrat, but all they do is call him a communist, and he is not a communist, has never been a communist. And yet, this is the kind of conflation that we saw all the time during the Red Scare. It didn't matter what your beliefs were. If you were on the left, you were suspect. I think we're going to see something very similar today. I mean, we already are seeing things that echo the Red Scare, but honestly, I think should Mamdani win, and he probably will, we're going to see a lot more explicit resurrecting or reappropriating of these sort of rhetorical tools of the 30s and 40s to go after progressives of all stripes.
So then talking about the Red Scare and really how it came about, you mentioned a few things, but I also just want to read another passage from your book, Red Scare. During his 1946 Senate campaign, a small-time Wisconsin judge named Joseph McCarthy ran an ad asking, "Tired of being pushed around? Do you like to have some government bureaucrat tell you how to manage your life? Who's to blame for all this? Nobody but the New Deal." You write, he won his race handily, and this was so interesting to learn about Clay, about the media. By 1953, the Chicago Tribune, the largest circulation newspaper in the Midwest and the country's leading voice of the right, I did not know that, and I'm sure a lot of others didn't know that, was openly railing against the, quote, communist-controlled New Deal.
Yeah, one of the things that we also forget, and even journalists, people in my profession forget, we idealize journalism of the past, for let's say back to World War II, and think, well, these were all times when people were just all newspapers were pretty objective, that there was this golden era of American journalism. And in fact, Yeah, while there were some newspapers that really did adhere to a fairly straight down the middle approach, there were a lot of prominent papers that did not, that not only in their editorial line, but even in their reporting, they broadly and openly embraced McCarthy and red baiting and the Red Scare. And you can see it in the headlines, you can see it in the way that they edited AP feeds, and that was a standard. That was not a weird sort of winger kind of approach. This is how journalism worked at the time. And when people ask, well, why was it so hard for the establishment media to deal with McCarthy? Part of it is that a lot of people in the establishment media openly embraced McCarthy. The Chicago Tribune being the leading voice of that wing. A lot of people didn't, but it wasn't like there was one media that sort of turned in sync to respond.
Today, we are speaking with Clay Risen about his new book, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Lorna who says, please talk about Roy Cohn. And in your book, you write that Roy Cohn was the distillation of everything that right-wing Republicans loved about McCarthy, including his vindictiveness and his willingness to lie. So can you talk about Roy Cohn and then, of course, his connections to Donald Trump?
Sure. So as people know, Roy Cohn was a young lawyer who had made his name in New York as a red baiter. He had been on the staff of the prosecution going after the Rosenbergs. There are a number of other cases that he was involved with that got him the attention of Joe McCarthy. And McCarthy had spent a couple of years. I mean, he first kind of came to prominence in 1950, and Roy Cohn didn't join him until 1953. And the reason is in 1952, there was a Republican wave election, and McCarthy played an important role in that. And so he got a chairmanship of the Government Operations Committee. He had a much bigger staff, so he needed to add people. And there was also, he himself understood that he was not a programmatic guy. That McCarthy was just a bull in a china shop, and he knew he was, and he thought that was a great thing, but he also needed to bring order to his operation. So Roy Cohn essentially became, the CEO of McCarthy Incorporated. He was brought in to kind of give sense to what was going on, to help run, to set up hearings, to help run investigations. He didn't may ultimately what he ended up doing was pushing McCarthy a lot further than I think McCarthy would have gone. And when you look at the thing that really took McCarthy down, his decision to go after the army and to accuse generals, including General George Marshall, one of the most respected figures in America, to accuse them of being communists and of being spies, which then in turn elicited the response of President Eisenhower and the rest of the Republican establishment. I don't know if McCarthy would have done that had he not had Cohn pushing him so hard. And yet, so as a consequence, as sort of part of the fallout of the McCarthy, Army McCarthy hearings and McCarthy's censure following that, Roy Cohn left the McCarthy McCarthy's employment. So he was really only there for a couple of years. He went back to New York and established himself as a lawyer who kind of took what he learned from McCarthy and the lessons that he developed around his time working with McCarthy, back to New York, and in combining his, really canny sense of politics. And Roy Cohn was a lot of things, but he was not stupid. He was a very effective thinker. And so he could take these lessons that McCarthy taught him, like never back down, always be on the attack, Lie if you have to, and if people call you out, move on to another lie. That was the way he worked for his clients. And, McCarthy had, or Roy Cohn had lots of clients before he met Donald Trump, and essentially became Donald Trump's, or Donald Trump became another project for him, in the same way that a young Cohn had seen McCarthy as a project. He approached Trump the same way. Here's somebody who clearly has all the personality elements and the potential that that to go really far in the world, but he needs to be tutored and he needs to have somebody there to sort of show him and to coach him. And I think the Apprentice, the movie, did a really effective job of showing how McCarthy, or how Cohn and Trump kind of work together in that way. And when you ask about through lines from the Red Scare to today, that's certainly one of the thickest, reddest threads running through that history.
Right. And in the PBS Frontline documentary, The Choice 2024, we learn, according to Roy Cohn's cousin, David Marcus, that when Trump met Roy Cohn, Roy said to him, "You might be guilty. It doesn't matter. Go after the Justice Department. Do not ever admit guilt."
Right. And I think that one of the things, it's one thing to say, oh, be opportunistic, always be on the attack. But the way that Cohn did that with McCarthy or with Trump, was a level, was a no holds barred style that most people in America just aren't used to. They're not ready for, right? The idea that you don't just deny your guilt, but you actually attack the people who are accusing you of guilt in the system, and to do it in an incredibly aggressive way, scorched earth. And to always, one of the things that McCarthy did, that Cohn helped him with, and that you see with Trump, is just constantly suing people. McCarthy sued his fellow senators, he sued members of the press, he sued really anybody who would criticize him. And that's not coincidental that that is a trick that Trump plays all the time. I mean, Trump doesn't necessarily think he's going to win any of his lawsuits, but it gives him a platform, and it is an annoyance and a huge expense for his targets. And as we've seen with so many settlements from big media companies, among others, it's very effective.
We are almost out of time, so we don't have time to take Tom's call, but Tom would like you to talk about the end of the Red Scare.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things that happened at the end to bring the Red Scare to an end. The first is just time passed, right? And the Cold War, which was, we haven't talked about it too much, but obviously the one of the motivating factors, the catalysts for the Red Scare, was the Cold War and the fear of a conflict with the Soviet Union. And that really sort of settled down by the mid-1950s. Stalin died, the Korean War ended. It kind of became apparent that the US and the Soviet Union would sort of have their separate spheres. And so that wasn't, the fear dropped out. But at the same time, there were a number of people who really stood up to the Red Scare and started to push back systematically. I talked about the media and how it took the media a while to figure out how to respond, but eventually they did. And newspapers got a lot better at how they dealt with McCarthy's lies, and generally with the lies of the Red Baiters. And some journalists in particular, and Edward R. Murrow, deserves enormous credit for really figuring out how to use television as a medium against McCarthy, and to talk about lies and mistruths in an effective way for an audience that was really shifting away from print. The legal system stood up as well. There were a number of lawyers, Arnold and Porter, the law firm, they worked hard, and it took a long time, but they did a lot of work to help to turn around at least the worst parts of the Red Scare in Washington, the idea that you could be fired for anonymous accusations over things that you never did. And in the Supreme Court as well, you know, part of what made this all possible was for a long time, the Supreme Court sat by and let these abuses pile up. And it was only when Earl Warren, the governor of California, a Republican, but a progressive one, came in, and it took him a little while to figure out how bad things were and the role that he had to play. But he eventually did, and he oversaw some in very important decisions that rolled back the architecture of the Red Scare, dismantled it so that, you know, even though it continued to be an epithet to call someone a communist, and there were still risks for a lot of people, the threats, the tools were not as prominent and not as likely to be used against you. And it gave courage to other folks. So that by the end of the 50s, you saw a lot of people willing to stand up to Congress, to stand up to the Red Baiters and say, you know, you all are a bunch of bullies. And you know, I think it's a positive story in that regard because America did figure out how to deal with this crisis inside.
And in our final minute, Clay, given that you ended on that note, coming back to today, what are your
Yeah.
thoughts about how major media outlets are covering what we're dealing with right now?
I think we still have a lot of work to do, to be honest. I think that there are some individual outlets that are doing great. I think that there are a lot that are not doing great. I think there are a lot in the middle that are just trying to figure out, and they've been trying to figure out for a long time. And, you know, I think especially with, and I don't want to speak for the New York Times, but in my experience as a reporter there, you know, we have an obligation to tell an objective, to get to the objective truth as much as possible, but also to not let down our, you know, not to set aside our skepticism and our critical faculties. And yet the ground is shifting so quickly that assumptions that we used to sort of be able to hedge all of that approach within have fallen apart. So, you know, do we call Trump an authoritarian? Do we call Trump a fascist? You know, I don't think that a lot of reporters are comfortable with that. Many are, but this is where the debate is. And no longer assuming good intentions on the part of government officials. You know, these are things that still have to be worked out and still have to be dealt with. And it's in an environment where the media is suffering. I mean, contracting as an industry, certainly public radio has lost a lot in the last couple of months. But all media is suffering. And so it's very hard to have a robust conversation, but it has to happen. And I can only say I'm hopeful that it'll happen in time.
Clay Risen is an award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times and author of Red Scare, Blacklist, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Thank you so much for your work, Clay, and thank you for joining us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.